Good afternoon, everybody. Wow, it's great to see so many people live and in person. Welcome, everybody online as well from all over the world. It's so cool to feel like we're right in the middle of the universe, everybody watching us right now. Hugh Ross is with us this morning. Everybody say yes. He's going to be doing a talk on the Great Migrations and Noah's Flood date, and he will be with us for the next few Sundays. On September 7th, we're going to have a guest presentation. Vance and Carol Nordman and Nancy Weigel from Paradoxes, we're going to do the Jesus film. And after I've heard Nancy talk about it like 800 times, I have never seen it, so I'm looking forward to that. And then on October 26th, as we've been announcing, we're going to do a Skeptics Forum. So the Skeptics Forum will be at the same time as class. We'll be going from 12:15 to 1 o'clock, and rather, 2 o'clock, sorry, 12:15 to 2 o'clock, hour of 45 minutes. And rather than Hugh spending most of the time talking and taking a few questions, he's going to do a short talk to get us all excited, and then it's mostly questions. We're designing it so that you can bring your unsaved friends, friends who are skeptical, or your own skeptical questions. But invite a bunch of people. Let's really pack this out. We're going to advertise it with the church, with universities and places in around town. We will be coming up with a flyer soon, so if you want to take some so that you can give it to friends or people at work or whatever, that would be fantastic. That'll be coming up October 26th, the last Sunday in October. Thank you to everybody who brought treats. One of the unusual treats back there is some cheesecake, which I brought. And the reason we brought cheesecake is because it is Dave Sargent's favorite food. And Dave Sargent, this is his last Sunday with us for quite a while. Dave, why don't you come on up? I want to ask you a few questions. So first off, where are you going and why?
Heading to Wyoming and to the city of Laramie. And that's because Wyoming only has one college, and that's the University of Wyoming in Laramie. And my daughter is a math professor there.
And how long have you been part of Paradox?
Going on 40 years.
Wow. And what is it in Wyoming that is that is causing you to be willing to live through a Wyoming winter?
She is very, very cute. My daughter, 3 months ago, had a baby girl, Elizabeth Ann, and so we're going up there to help take care of her. Two things. One, my daughter with a PhD needs to continue working because she's the breadwinner in the family. And B, she had a very difficult delivery, and she's actually still recovering from the delivery. So we're going up there to help her. And keep her in her prayer. Her name is Christina. And again, she had a very difficult delivery, and she's still recovering from it.
So family is thicker than snow. Okay. Well, I want to say thank you, Dave. I've known you since I've been in class since about 99. So most of the time you've been here, but you've been here a lot longer than I, and you've always been a really important, active part of this class. It's going to feel different without you. So hopefully we will be able to see you online, and you'll be coming back for some, you know, a little shot of sunshine once in a while, especially during the winter. So do you mind if I say a prayer?
Please.
Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for our brother, Dave Sargent, and Barbara Sargent. We pray for their joy and peace being in a different part of the country, Lord, and we just thank you for their service in this class and what they've meant to this class. Please bless them, be with them, bless their family, keep them all close to you, Lord. Thank you so much. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, Dave. All right, with that, let's welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back here in the class. I've been gone for two Sundays. Two Sundays ago, I was speaking at the American Scientific Affiliation. That's an organization of scientists who are Christians and they gather together every year to present about 50 different talks. And so I gave a talk on the flood. Also gave a talk, I was the preacher for the Sunday morning service. And you'll be encouraged that the message that they wanted me to deliver, so I gave them a variety of choices. The one they chose for me to present on Sunday morning was the one I presented here in class, which was the salt of the earth, and got a really good response from everybody there. And the lecture I gave at the conference was the one I'm actually going to give today. So this will be the second time I've given the talk. What was interesting, it was a talk on the Great Migrations that the Bible talks about in Genesis 10 and 11, the event that takes place after Noah's flood. And the response I got from the scientists and theologians that were at this conference were, this solves all the problems that people have about Noah's flood, just that one little piece. So we've been talking about Noah's flood for months now, but this is the talk I gave there. And now, you know, we were trying to, you know, we have a comedian in the class, but he doesn't always come on time. And that we always wanted to start the class with a joke. And I put some pressure on Ross to start with a joke. I've got one for you today, and it's a really bad joke. You know, my sons, they have all their friends come over, and they say, Dad, please tell us one of your really bad jokes. So, you know, sons are like that, right? But here it is. Never trust atoms. They make up everything. Okay. All right. I'll accept your apologies afterwards. So, and yeah, so if you got questions, I always take questions at the end of the teaching time here. And for those of you that are new online, we'll take questions on any subject. And so we try to structure the class 30 minutes of teaching and about 45 minutes of Q&A. Okay, dating Noah's flood. Now, the last time I was with you, I basically went through the genealogies in the Bible, making the point that the genealogies are not a useful tool for trying to date Adam and Eve, trying to date Noah. They become useful tools in terms of trying to establish dates, say, from Abraham forward, or actually, really, from Moses forward. But anything previous to Moses, they're not reliable because none of the genealogies in the Bible are complete. Names are dropped, names are added, and the way to study the genealogies in the Bible is to look at each one and say, who's included and who's not included? Because the names that are there are all in, with the intent of making a theological point. And so sometimes it makes a point of mentioning people who have committed grievous sins, making the point, hey, God is able to forgive. Other times it's making the point that, hey, when it talks about the children of Jacob, notice how frequently the tribe of Daniel is dropped. And they'll throw in two names for the tribe of Joseph. It's making a point that you'll see when you look at the context of the book of Judges, for example. Okay, so what are the useful tools for trying to come up with a date for Noah's flood? Well, one that you get from Genesis chapter 8 is that the flood took a whole year to recede. So for 40 days and 40 nights, there was these torrential rains, and says God brought up water from the underground aquifers. So there's telling you the source of the waters that flooded the region and wiped out all the ungodly people that were on the face of the earth at that time. So it was 40 days and 40 nights, but the flood lasted 1 year and 10 days. So it literally took almost an entire year for the floodwaters to recede so that Noah and his family and their animals could disembark from the ark. And that it took a full year for the floodwaters to recede is an indication that Noah's flood occurred during an ice age. The reason I say that is that whenever you see a flood, what happens with the waters? The water runs downhill into the oceans, or runs down into the ground and fills the underground aquifers. And so every time you have a flood, the water will recede either onto the ocean or into the aquifers, And notice it does it fairly quickly. So if you have a flood that lasts several weeks, the flood waters typically recede within days, maybe a week or two. But for the flood waters to hang around for nearly a whole year, you need to replace the water that's flowing out into the oceans and into the aquifers with another supply of water. And the reason why I make the conclusion that Noah's flood, according to Genesis 8, must have occurred during an ice age is only during an ice age do you have these major melt events. And what's particularly interesting about the previous ice age, the ice age that just preceded the interglacial we're in right now, had the greatest melt events that has ever happened during an ice age. And it didn't just have one or two. It had over a dozen distinct major flood events. In fact, what's distinctive about the previous ice age, it was one where you get ice forming over the high latitude land masses, and we're talking about ice forming thousands of feet thick. But also there'd be warming events where those thousands of feet thickness of ice would rapidly melt away, then the cold would come back and they would reform. And so typically people think of an ice age as one where you have a permanent cap of ice thousands of feet thick covering 20 to 23% of the surface of the Earth. That's actually not a correct picture of the previous ice age. Rather, it's one of this ice forming quickly, receding quickly, and coming back. So what we see during the last ice age is that the global mean temperature is jumping up and down by 18 degrees Fahrenheit, or 10 degrees centigrade. And so when the temperature goes up, the ice melts away, and when the temperature falls down, the ice reforms. And so you can actually look at the previous ice age of one of multiple ice ages, where you got ice covering, say, half of North America, thousands of feet thick, the ice melting and reforming. And so that explains why, for example, in North America, we have such spectacular scenic relief. I mean, just think of Yosemite Valley. Yosemite Valley was created during the last ice age and was created by ice covering that part of California thousands of feet thick. Then you get a melt event, that ice would melt, and when ice is forming and melting, it basically carves out these gigantic canyons. And because North America had the greatest coverage of ice, literally 55% of North America was covered with ice at certain times during the previous ice age. Matter of fact, those of you who like to go to San Diego for a vacation, make sure you do it during an interglacial, because during the last ice age, during the winter time, the port of San Diego was completely frozen over. Matter of fact, the ice and the winter time actually went all the way down into Mexico. And so, but that also explains why we have the kind of scenery we do in North America compared to other parts of the world. Okay, the date for the previous ice age is between 120,000 and 13,000 years ago. And where you have these rapid melt events is 78,000 to 14,000 years ago. So I would argue that that's probably a likely date for Noah's flood. Maybe the event of, there was one at 78,000 years ago, one at 71, one at about 60 to 63. So there's several major melt events that happen deep into the last ice age. And that means that as the water flowed out into the Indian Ocean, into the Mediterranean, and filled the underground aquifers, that water was being replaced by ice melting on the mountains that surrounded the place where people lived. So, for example, during the last ice age, the mountains of Arabia, the mountains of Persia, were covered with thick ice. Today, there's no ice there at all. In fact, the only mountain in that region that has ice on it today is Mount Ararat. But during the last ice age, even mountains that were just 5,000 to 6,000 feet above sea level would be covered with thick glaciers. And so during a major melt event, that ice would melt, and that would basically cause water to flow in. And the thing about melting ice and snow, it melts slowly. And so you would get a permanent flow of water from the slowly melting snow and ice, replacing the water that's flowing onto the ocean. If you want an analogy, there was a flood roughly three decades ago here in North America that covered the Mississippi Valley, and where the Mississippi River overflowed its banks and overflowed it by a vertical stretch of 50 feet. So think of the Mississippi plains, and put 50 feet of water. That's what was happening three decades ago. And that flood of 50 feet thickness overflowing the banks of the Mississippi, it literally persisted for almost 4 months. And yes, water was flowing out into the Gulf of Mexico, but as fast as the water flowed into the Gulf of Mexico, you had snow and ice melting in the Rockies here in the United States. And keep in mind, the Mississippi is actually fed by rivers in Canada. And so all the snow and ice covering those mountains. What was happening that year, they had an exceptionally warm spring. And so with that warm spring, you had this massive melting of snow and ice on the mountains, and literally caused the Mississippi Valley to overflood by 50 feet thickness for 4 months. And so just scale it up a little bit, we can understand how it is that Noah and his family had to wait a whole year for the floodwaters to completely secede. So rather than having a flood date of, say, 5,000 to 6,000 years ago that many people claim, we actually have a date for the flood that's significantly earlier. Now, so supporting biblical evidence that the flood indeed dated early rather than quite recently, is you notice in Genesis chapter 9 after the flood, we have God telling Noah that he needs to multiply and fill the earth. Likewise, we see in Genesis, the early chapters of Genesis, Genesis 2:1, 2, and 3, God likewise talks to Adam and Eve and tells them to multiply and fill the earth. So in just the first 9 chapters of the Bible, we have God 4 times telling humanity that they're to multiply and fill the earth. Now, that's one reason I argue that humanity had not filled the earth. Why would we have 4 commands, and why would the commands in Genesis 9 be much sharper and direct than the commands we see in Genesis 1, 2, and 3? It's an indication that humanity before the flood had failed to fill the earth. And also what you notice is that God speaks to Noah in Genesis chapter 9 and says, look, I'm not going to tolerate all the murder that was going on in the days before the flood. From now on, you need to be responsible to restrain the expression of murder. And basically told Noah, if necessary, use the death penalty to restrain the expression of murder. And basically he was telling Noah, look, the reason why I had to step in with a flood before is that humanity was in danger of self-extermination. As we talked about here in the class, in the days before the flood, the murder rate amongst human beings was above 90%, probably above 95%. And I say murder rate, I mean that the cause of death for humans, 95% of all humans had their life being terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. So literally, humanity was in danger of wiping itself out. And so understandably, God tells Noah after the flood, look, I'm not going to have this degree of murder happening again. You must set up a governmental system whereby when people start killing one another, they're going to be restrained by the judicial system. And whatever means you need to do it to make sure that murder does not run out of control. And so this again would imply, by the way, there was a limit in terms of the penalty you could impose upon people who murder their fellow man. Only the murderer could be dealt with. Only the murderer could have his life terminated, not the family members, not the friends. And you see this again brought out in the Levitical law, that there's a limit to how far the government can go. But basically saying, I don't want you to be lax about people killing one another. It must be restrained. Now, a lot of people think what you see in Genesis 9 is a command that all murderers are to be killed. No, it's just simply saying, if you need to use the death penalty, do it. But if you can restrain murder by lesser means, you can go for that as well. It's the maximum penalty that's being implied. So, but this again tells us that humanity had not yet filled the earth. Human population hadn't risen, they hadn't spread out over all the earth, and also implies that Noah's flood must have occurred before the great dispersal. Genesis 10 and 11 is the first time we see humanity in a global context, you know, where God steps in and scatters humanity over the face of the earth. In fact, what you see in particular in Genesis chapter 11, several generations after the flood, we see that God's command to multiply and fill the earth is not being obeyed. What you see in Genesis chapter 11 is you got humans gathering together and saying, you know, let's build this great city. Let's build a tower in the middle of the city so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth, that we can be one people, one nation, and one region. And God had commanded four times, you're not to do that. You're to multiply and fill the earth. You're not to stay in just one region. Moreover, you're not to be just one people group. You're not to be just one nation. You're to be multiple nations. And what you see in Genesis chapter 11 is that God took this one nation and broke it up into multiple nations, scattered them over the face of the earth, and gave them different languages so they would have a challenge communicating with one another. It also tells us in Genesis chapter 11 that he had established the continents of the earth with natural borders so that a weak nation could survive next to a strong nation. And so he basically established the seven continents of the world, where you got mountain ranges, you got major rivers, you got seas, you got oceans, you got deserts, you got rainforests, and all of these serve as natural barriers that would impede a powerful nation from conquering all the weaker nations around it. And with the multiple languages, it'd be a challenge to try to group all these people into one nation. People are naturally going to want to, associate with people that are speaking the same language that they are. Now, this also allows us a tool to try to date when Noah's flood takes place. Because when the time of Noah and previous to Noah, all people were speaking one language. Incidentally, I think I've mentioned this before in the class, the reason God was intent on breaking up this one nation and having multiple nations speaking different languages with one another, he knew that one nation controlling all of humanity would be a prescription for oppression. The principle of antitrust legislation. If you have one corporation having 100% control over a product, what is that corporation typically going to do? Well, the leaders, like all of us, are sinful. They're going to say, this is a great opportunity to raise the price of the product and lower its quality so we can become wealthier. Well, the same principle applies to nations. If you got one nation in control of all the peoples of the world, of the leaders of that nation, they're going to impress the citizens, and they're going to make life more restrictive so that the leaders indeed can be enriched. And so God says, no, we're going to have multiple nations that are going to need to compete with one another for citizens, and this will be a restraint on the leaders of the different nations from applying too much oppression upon their people. Now, of course, you could argue all nations oppress their citizens. I mean, two things you can't avoid, right? Death and taxes. And we kind of look at taxes as an oppression. On the other hand, all nations need some level of taxation just to have the government operate. But notice how frequently people will leave one nation to go to another nation with lower taxes. And so the fact that you have multiple nations means that, you know, the government leaders are going to be motivated not to tax their citizens to such a degree that they're all going to leave that nation and go to another nation. And that's the wonderful thing about living in a nation with 50 states. If you're in a state where the state government is overly oppressing its citizens, you got the option of packing your bags and going to a state where things aren't quite as oppressive. Of course, that state might make things more oppressive. You might want to move back. But that was the principle of our founding fathers of the United States. They wanted a federal system with multiple states as a way of restraining the temptation of state governments from overly oppressing its citizens. But this does provide us with a tool. Okay, let's look at the different languages of the world and see if we can actually establish a date when we can trace the diversification of languages back to a single language. And so there are many papers on this. I'll be citing them in the book I'm bringing out on Noah's Flood, but here's a brief summary. You know, we speak what I refer to as an Indo-European language. English is an Indo-European language. All the European languages are called Indo-European. It's also the languages you see throughout much of the Middle and Near East. And so you can kind of look at the different languages that make up the Indo-European family, and you can go back in the books and the writings of these different languages in time and basically try to come up with a rough calculation. Okay, we notice that these languages tend to multiply with respect to time. Let's look at where we are presently. Let's go back into the most ancient literature, 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, see what the diversity is like there, see where the geography is, because typically when people move from one region of the world to another region of the world, they take their language with them, but the language evolves a little bit. Matter of fact, you know, I've spoken in 48 of the 50 states of the United States, but I can tell you when I was speaking in Mississippi, I often thought the people there were speaking a foreign language. It was English, but it was a different kind of English than we speak here in California. And that typically happens. That's one way languages diversify. People move to a different region, and often they wind up marrying with a different people group that speaks a different language. So, for example, when you go to southern Louisiana, a lot of people speak Creole. Why? Because the French were the ones that first settled Louisiana. Then they sold Louisiana to the United States. But that mix of French and English has persisted. And also, there's the Indian culture that they adopted. And so, you know, when French people go to southern Louisiana, they say, this doesn't look like a mixture of French and English because it's more complex than that. And so we call it a Creole language. So, and for that matter, there are parts of Los Angeles where I've been speaking where there's a dialect there that is challenging for me to understand. So a little bit about the diversification of languages. But people who've looked at the writings of different languages with respect to geography have calculated that the time back to where there was a single Indo-European language was 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. Now, I want to make the point that that's a lower limit. It could have been earlier, but we know that the time back to a single language can't be any later than 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. Now, there's also the Austronesian language family. And these are basically the languages that are spoken throughout Polynesia and Eastern Asia. They're distinct from the Indo-European languages, but likewise, people have looked at the way the different languages we have today, what we see in the ancient writings, what we see in their art, and they're able to determine that the origin of the Austronesian languages must date back at least 13,000 to 17,000 years ago, and have actually determined that the origin of all languages, or all the languages that are spoken, North and South America, Australia, Asia, Europe, and Africa, that the time back to a single language must be earlier than 20,000 years ago. And again, I want to emphasize these are limits. It could be a lot earlier, but we know it goes back at least that time. Okay. But where I want to segue now is where I think we get the best evidence for the date of Noah's flood. And that is what we see in Genesis 10 and 11, where God looks down upon what's happening in the Mesopotamian plain and says all the peoples of the world are building this city and this tower so that they can have just one nation where humanity can be in one region and basically leave the rest of the planet uninhabited. And you would think, if you look at Genesis chapter 1, they would figure out why. God told Adam and Eve that they were to multiply and fill the earth. Why? So they could rule over all the earth, rule over all of its animals, rule over all of its resources. How can that happen if humanity is just in one location? That means there's no governance of what's going on, say, in Australia, North America, or South America, or Europe, or Western Africa. There's no people there. So there's no governance going on. Because God's command was, I want you to rule over all the life on planet Earth and all of its resources, so with wisdom you can manage it for your benefit and the benefit of all life, which implies you've got to be living there. And humanity was not doing that. They're saying, we're just going to live in this one place. Okay, this next map is my attempt to determine what was the maximum extent of human habitation before God scattered humanity over the whole face of the earth. So this is the maximum extent, say, of pre-flood humanity and immediately after the flood, post-flood humanity. It could be a smaller region than that, but that would be the maximum regional extent. And this is the location where we find the earliest artifacts that we can associate with human beings. Basically fits within that little red oval region. Now, what I'm showing you here is a map of the old world, Africa, Asia, and Europe, during an interglacial. What I want to now show you is what the world looked like during the last ice age. Because in this particular map, we notice that there the Mediterranean Sea separates Spain from Africa. During the last ice age, there was a land bridge joining Africa to Spain. Cyprus was not an island. It was joined by a land bridge. Matter of fact, if you take a vacation in Greece, what are there? Thousands of Grecian islands in the Ionian Sea. During the last ice age, there was no Ionian Sea. It was all one gigantic landmass. Why? Because when you got thousands of feet of ice covering Siberia and North America and Europe and the southern parts of Australia and South America, that means that the sea levels will be a lot lower. How much lower? We're talking between 200 feet below the present sea level to 390 feet below the present sea level. So here I'm showing you a map of what the continents looked like during the last ice age. And so Newfoundland is actually now part of the mainland. And notice that the Hudson's Bay is all one landmass, so North America is a lot bigger. There's a 500-mile-wide land bridge joining Alaska to Siberia. We actually have Greenland joined to North America. Then you look at the old world, and you really can't see the British Isles. The British Isles are all one gigantic landmass connected with France. And you notice that Spain is connected to Africa. There's a land bridge joining Arabia to Eastern Africa. The Persian Gulf is completely, becomes one gigantic landmass. The islands in the Mediterranean are all connected together. And if you look over towards Eastern Asia, you notice that Japan, Borneo, the Philippines, Taiwan, they're all joined together to the mainland by landmasses. So it explains why, for example, we find early artifacts and the bones of humans in the islands of Indonesia and of Borneo, because they were all connected by land bridges with the Asian mainland. And notice Australia is a much bigger continent. It's joined together with New Guinea, it's joined together with Tasmania. Now you still got New Zealand as an island out there. And then we can zoom in here to what you see in Europe, the Mediterranean. Now, two colors here you see in the map. The brown that you see there is basically landmass during the last ice age when the sea levels were relatively high, 250 to 200 feet below present sea level. Add to that the yellow. So where you see the yellow, that would be when the sea levels were like 390 feet below sea level. And so what you notice there is that we got Italy connected with Africa. Spain is connected with northern Africa. Cyprus is connected. Notice that the Black Sea is less than half the size that it is now. And the Adriatic Sea doesn't exist. Italy is connected with the Yugoslavian area that existed. In fact, all the islands in the Mediterranean Sea are connected. The Mediterranean Sea basically shrinks about half the size that it is now. Now, I think you can see from this map that when God scatters humanity, they can walk. They don't need boats. They can literally walk to all these places because all of the land bridges connecting everything. And here we zoom in on what's happening with Southern Asia and Australia. And we do see, the names that you see are Sunda and Sahul. Sahul refers to the Australia that existed during the last ice age, where you basically have it completely connected with land to New Guinea. In fact, all of the islands off of New Guinea are connected. Tasmania is connected. So Australia is about 50% bigger than it is today. And most of Indonesia is collected, joined together by a gigantic landmass. In fact, we got Borneo connected with the Philippines. Instead of the Philippine islands being 50,000 islands, it's just a couple of big islands. Now, it is true that you still got a strait separating the southern part of Asia with Australia. But what is interesting is that now the separation between southern Southeast Asia and Australia is such that people can actually see Australia from Asia. And so it's not like today where if you're even the biggest or the smallest strait, you look across and you can't see Australia. Back then, they could see Australia, which means that people could say, oh, there's land there. Let's build a boat and let's actually go over there to Australia. And I'll share with you next week a new discovery that just got published a couple of months ago. I was able to present this at the American Scientific Affiliation meeting, how they've now found in the most southern parts of Indonesia remnants of giant pieces of rope. And as they looked at the rope, they said this rope could only have one purpose. It had to be the purpose for building gigantic seafaring vessels. And the date on that goes back 40,000 years ago. And that was a major factor in the talk I gave at the American Scientific Affiliation, because they were saying, oh, this actually shows that people 40,000 years ago were capable of building really big boats. And these are boats that people built basically to take their animals and supplies and families from Southeast Asia over to Australia and begin to populate Australia. Now, these ropes would be the case for boats that needed to be steered, boats that we use for, say, throwing down an anchor, for establishing sails, or for a rudder. The interesting thing about Noah's Ark, it didn't have to go anywhere. All it had to do was float. So it didn't need a rudder, didn't need sails, which means that its engineering challenges would be much less than the case for building a boat that you want to be able to steer and make sure it goes where you want it to go. But it is evidence that ancient peoples actually had the technology, the capability of making big boats. Okay, where I'm going to go with you on this next week is we're going to actually look at how they're able to date these great migrations. And for the first time, we've got four independent tools for dating where and when these migrations took place. I mean, when I was first studying this during my 20s, we didn't have any remains of human beings that dated back very far. Typically, the most ancient remains we had of anatomically modern humans dated back about 10,000 years ago. They now got remains that date back 40 to 50,000 years ago. And we got the means for dating them. So you got the fossils of human remains. We can figure out where they are, get a date for them. You can also find artifacts that we know must be associated with anatomically modern humans. Because what's been happening lately in the scientific literature, they're realizing when you look at, the Denisovans, the Neanderthals, and Homo erectus, they have tools, they have artifacts, but they're dramatically different from the tools and artifacts of anatomically modern humans. As such that we now realize present-day humans are not part of the family of the Homos. In other words, we're radically distinct from the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, and Homo erectus. And that's verified in the fact that the tools we have, the artifacts we have, are much more advanced. Something I'll be sharing with you next week is we now know for the first time early humans, the earliest humans, in fact, this would go back to Adam and Eve, must have been preparing their food and cooking their food. Why? Because we now notice that the anatomy of modern human beings compared with, the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, the Homo erectus, those species of bipedal primates had an anatomy and a bone and muscular structure so they could literally survive by chewing raw foods. We humans don't have that. Put us in a place where we have to eat nothing but raw vegetables and raw meat, we would die. The reason why we survived the way we did is that we were able to cook our food, roast it, grind it, boil it, and basically have a diet of soft food. So if you look at all the treats on the treat table over there, notice how much of that stuff is prepared for easy chewing. And so, you can relax and enjoy things with your fellow people here in the class because you don't have to exert thousands of calories just to chew your food up. It's nice and soft. It's all prepared. We now know this is the case even for the first humans, which tells us anatomically modern humans were advanced from the get-go. Right away, they had the capability of preparing food. We'll talk about that next time and also genetic analysis. So come next week, we'll talk about diet and how our diet differs from others and how the ancients, and for the first time, we now have evidence that the earliest humans indeed were involved in very sophisticated food preparation. So that will take questions, and as always, we'll take questions on any subject within reason. And we'll alternate between people that are present here in the class and people that are joining us from the World Wide Web online. Sounds like we've got a web question.
And I want to mention first, lately it's been difficult to get people in the class to get up and come over here and ask Dr. Ross a question. So please, if you've got a question, come over here, but we will start with an internet question. Craig McMahon, where is it? Oh boy, now I lost the whole thing. Hang on. Craig McMahon says, Hugh, you mentioned there was data indicating mass human dispersion 30 to 40,000 years ago. What is that evidence?
The evidence for?
Mass human dispersion 30 to 40,000 years ago.
Okay, I'm going to be going into that evidence in some detail next week. This is basically the first slide that basically says now we don't just have one method, we got four methods. And so four distinct dating methods, and you basically take these remains and look at the location and you look at the date. And so for example, this data is now so extensive, we actually know where the migration routes are. You know, when they happened, when they migrated. So we'll be getting into that in some detail next week.
Okay, very good. Tom Longo, our friend in Tennessee, says, Dr. Ross, I have seen a lot in the media about a ninth planet being found in the Oort cloud. Can you add to this?
Yes. Well, it's somewhat speculative, and we do know that there's a possibility for a ninth planet. in the sense that we now know that the solar system, in order to explain its present-day structure and the evidence for the moon, must have begun with five rocky planets and five gas giant planets. And one of the rocky planets merged with the early Earth, and that explains the origin of the moon. But to explain why Mars is as small as it is, we need to have one of the five gas giant planets either being completely ejected from the solar system or ejected about 50 times farther away than Neptune is from the sun. And so astronomers are basically trying to figure out which of those two scenarios is correct. And they're looking at objects in the distant Kuiper belt and the Oort cloud. We have at least one confirmed Oort cloud object. It's the mini planet Sedna, looking at its orbit, but looking at the orbits of different asteroids and comets in the distant Kuiper belt, and basically saying, do we see in those orbits any evidence for this fifth planet? By the way, we know that this fifth planet that got kicked out or ejected far away from the sun weighs about 10 times the mass of the Earth. So they know its mass, and they're looking at orbits of distant objects in the asteroid and comet belts to see if they can see an orbital conglomeration that would indicate the existence of that ninth planet. There is some evidence, it's not conclusive. So far we don't know if this ninth planet exists. What caught the news recently is there's an astronomer at Harvard University who said, hey, we've now detected two comets that are actually interstellar comets. In other words, they're comets that got captured by our solar system. By the way, I think we're going to find a whole bunch of them because our star, the sun, is more massive than about 90% of the stars in our solar system, which means every time our solar system comes by another stellar system where the star is less mass, that means our solar system's got a high probability of capturing some of the asteroids and comets. Also, we now know there's a bunch of asteroids and comets that are just floating free between the stars. Likewise, our sun is able to capture some of those. So far, we found two bodies that we know for sure are interstellars. But some people looking at those interstellar comets and saying maybe their orbital paths will tell us something about the possible existence of a ninth planet. But again, nothing is settled. We do know it's one of those two possibilities, but we don't know which one is true yet. So those of you who have T-shirts with the eight planets on them, a day will come you might have to put a ninth one on it. Who knows?
Hi.
Hi.
I was interested in the problem of migration during the Ice Age. I mean, the Earth is covered with ice, and people are going to have trouble not only feeding themselves and keeping themselves alive. So I guess this must involve that you have the appearance and disappearance of the Ice Age. So maybe they're traveling when the ice is down, when it's gone away, because anyway, if you'd address that issue of how people. How people could be successful in moving distances with all that ice.
Right. Well, during the last ice age, ice covered as much as 23% of the land masses of our planet. And if you look at this particular map here, you notice that Siberia extends way closer to the North Pole than it does today. What they've now discovered is that northern plain, which is above Siberia today, was actually inhabited during the latter part of the Ice Age. And the reason why is that with the sea levels dropping and that northern plain being exposed, it was ameliorated in terms of its temperature by the Arctic Ocean, and was actually much warmer than the parts of Siberia to the south of it. So the region of Siberia just below that latitude was uninhabited. but that plain that is now underwater was indeed inhabited. So people lived where it was warm, and where it was just covered with ice, they didn't. But what's interesting, and we'll talk about this next week, you know, all the regions of Africa, Asia, and Europe that were not covered with ice during the last ice age quickly became inhabited, and they quickly became inhabited virtually at the same time, verifying what we see in Genesis 10 and 11, that God indeed aggressively scattered humanity over that whole region. Now, North and South America were not inhabited in quite a bit later. So we're literally looking at a date about 30,000 years after the colonization of all of Africa, Europe, and Asia before North and South America became inhabited. Why? Because there was an ice barrier that prevented them from moving from Siberia into Alaska. So humanity had to wait until that time when it was possible to cross over the Bering Land Bridge. And I'm going to be sharing with you that there's actually a scriptural reference for that. It's in Genesis 10:25, where it talks about the world being divided in the days of Peleg. And if you look at the genealogy in Genesis 11, Peleg is way down the genealogy from Noah, which means many, many generations after Noah, we have the world being divided. And I'm going to argue that's a reference to the Bering Land Bridge disappearing. So there was a time when the ice began to melt from the Bering Land Bridge, sea levels were going up, it became warm enough that there was actually food along the way for people to cross over the Bering Land Bridge. But that epoch when humans could cross over on foot from Siberia to North America was only about 3,000 years wide, because the ice age was coming to an end, sea levels rose by several hundred feet, and you got the Bering Strait. And the Bering Strait is cold, treacherous water, because you've got these powerful currents moving between Siberia and Alaska, and basically made it impossible for humans to cross from Asia into North America. So it's just a brief window when humans can do that. And so we'll be looking into that next week.
So basically then, the ice age, really, its impact is in drawing water out of the sea and lowering the sea level, but that's not covering a lot of the areas, a lot of the routes where people are actually moving. So that, the routes of transportation were still there with a lower sea level.
Okay, what I'm going to be sharing with you next week is that what facilitated this very rapid, aggressive migration were the sea coasts. So for example, how you explain how people got from the Middle East to Australia as rapidly as they did, they basically were migrating along the seashore of Southern Asia. And I'm going to be sharing why that was such an efficient means of migration. And later on, when humans got into North America, they literally went from Alaska to the south tip of Australia in less than 1,000 years. Mainly they used the west coast as a migration route. And I'll be explaining to you why that's such an efficient migration route. I mean, hey, here in California, this class is not that far from the beach, right? When you're on a beach, it's a lot easier to walk on the beach than it is in a thick rainforest. You know, there's usually not a lot of thorns and thistles on the beach. Moreover, when you're walking along a beach, there's food that you can grab as you walk. There's seaweed you can pick up. There's clams and oysters you can harvest. There's fish you can get. And if you go to where there's no sand, there's all kinds of vegetables and fruit you can pick. So this makes it easy for people to move quickly from one region to another region.
Thank you, Hugh. Frank McInnes asks, if the Giza Pyramid was made by a lost civilization 10,000 years ago, and also we note that the Sphinx shows water erosion, could Noah's flood explain the destruction of this civilization and the water erosion of the Sphinx?
Well, most of the erosion of the Sphinx has actually happened in the last 100 years. And so it's basically the industrialization of Egypt that has put certain chemicals into the atmosphere that's been eroding away the Sphinx. And, you know, you can actually look at photographs of the Sphinx that were taken like 150 years ago, and the Sphinx looks a whole lot different than it does today. You know, my wife and I visited Egypt in 1980, and even then, we could see significant corrosion. But almost all that corrosion is recent. So it's got nothing to do with the flood. The Sphinx was built long, long after the flood had ended. You know, it's a relatively recent structure that's there. But yeah, these things are eroded. And, you know, we're talking a flood that's 40,000 years ago or earlier. Structures like that would be completely eroded away. But the erosion today is much higher than it was even a century ago.
Good afternoon. My question is, you mentioned that the pre-flood murder rate was 90 to 90%, or it was 90 to 90% of deaths.
Yes.
So I was wondering how you know that.
How do I know that the my murder rate was that high?
Yes.
There is a chapter in the book Navigating Genesis where I go into some detail, but let me just be very brief. Okay, assume people are not murdering one another. And what you notice is that in the first genealogy you see in the Bible, Genesis 5, it's basically a genealogy where none of the men in the genealogy died of murder. They were dying of natural causes, with the exception of Enoch, who was taken away by God to heaven before he passed. But as you look at the lifespans, it's running between like 750 years and 970 years. So they were living a long time. And so if you take away the murder, then you would have a rapid population growth. So, you know, like most animals, they're reproductive for two-thirds or more of their lifespan. And so if you've got people living to be 900 years of age on the average, and they're reproductive for two-thirds of the lifetime, that means all of you ladies here, you'd be having a lot of children because there wouldn't be very effective birth control methods. The most effective method that the descendants of Adam and Eve would have would be the rhythm method without the benefit of thermometers. And experiments tell us that in such a situation, each woman is having a child about once every 3 years. And so I conservatively just say, well, let's just say it's one child every 4 years for 600 years. That's 150 children per woman. And so if you got 150 children being born from every woman, you get a rather rapid population explosion. So, yeah, go ahead.
But wouldn't, well, a lot of women were dying in childbirth. So wouldn't that happen?
Okay, you could have some dying in childbirth. You could say, well, maybe some of them were dying from being injured. I mean, you could take that all into account. But here's what I've done in Navigating Genesis. I say, let's assume that death in childbirth for the women and the child was below 10%. So 90% of the women survived, 90% of the children survived. And that, you know, also a low injury rate. And then just see what happens to the population. What happens is you realize, okay, when God told Adam, multiply and fill the earth, he could have done it in his own lifespan. I basically show you, even with conservative estimates of how many children you get per couple, and again, being conservative about people dying from other causes, you still wind up with 17 billion people on the face of the earth by the time Noah is 720 years of age. And clearly, the population didn't hit 17 billion. If that was the case, we would have a lot of evidence supporting that high population level. It's possible that the population might have gone up into the low millions. That could escape detection by modern-day means, but not the billions. And so how do you explain the fact that the population didn't get up into the billions in just the first 1,000 years of a humanity after Adam and Eve? Well, murder would be one way. And notice, murder is addressed in Genesis chapter 4. You actually have a descendant of Cain boasting about murdering Seven. And you have the very strong injunctions in the chapter 9 about restraining murder. And you've got the statements in Genesis 6 that at the time of Noah, every human being outside of Noah's family was intent on doing great physical harm to their fellow man. Two words are used, shakak and hamas, two Hebrew words that are unique to Genesis 6 that basically talk about just how violent people were at that time. And so with that degree of violence, we would presume that the murder rate was high. In fact, I actually argue that our generation right now is experiencing the longest average lifespan of any generation of humanity who's ever lived. I mean, if you eat your vegetables, you got a good chance of making it to be 90 years of age, right? As long as you exercise every day and do other reasonable things, you'll make it to 90. I calculated that the average lifespan of people living in the days of Noah before the flood was probably in the neighborhood of 40 years or less. So people were typically being killed by their fellow man when they were in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And what we're seeing in Genesis chapter 5 is the very few individuals that escape by being murdered by their fellow man.
Hugh Terry LB asks the question, says in Genesis 3:6, the woman saw that the tree was good for food. Does that indicate that it was already being eaten?
The fact that the tree was good for food, does that indication it was already being eaten?
How would she know that it was good for food if they hadn't eaten it yet?
Well, maybe she saw some fruit flies flying around the fruit. I don't know. Or other animals eating it, or she might have smelled it. So, there are lots of fruit trees in the Garden of Eden. She might have looked at that tree and said, hey, this fruit looks even better. I mean, think of your children. Take your children into a wilderness walk. What I've noticed with my sons when they were just 2 years of age, they were basically trying to eat everything that they could find on the trail. And so I had to tell them, no, don't eat that, but it's okay to eat that. And so, again, I would think early humans would have quickly recognized, boy, that looks like it might be something good to eat. I take a bite of it, well, that tastes awful, I'm not going to eat that. Or this tastes really good. I mean, kind of what I told my sons when we were going into the Canadian wilderness is, if it tastes sweet, it's probably safe to eat. If it tastes bitter, better leave it alone. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. How would you help a neurodivergent individual with coming to terms with the reality of their difficulties and find a peace with it in a Christ-centered way?
Run that by me again.
So I'm a neurodivergent person like you, and I'm asking, how would you help a neurodivergent individual with coming to terms with the reality of their difficulties?
Yes.
And find peace with it in a Christ-centered way?
Right. Well, I've actually been invited to give a talk in this church on that very subject. I've given it in other churches, basically taking 2 Corinthians 4, which makes the point that God has blessed every human being with deficiencies, weaknesses, and defects. Why? Because God wants other people to see the Holy Spirit in his followers shining through their defects. And so more they realize, oh, that's not so-and-so, that's not John. That must be the Spirit in John manifesting it. And the exhortation you see in 2 Corinthians 4, don't work so hard of covering up your deficiencies. That's our normal tendency. You know, let's cover up the weaknesses and deficiencies we have. I mean, why do people wear the clothes they do to make themselves look stronger than they really are? How we get certain surgeries done to make ourselves look more younger than we are? That's a normal human tendency. Now, how should we counteract that? Again, we go to 2 Corinthians 4 and says that all of us have certain neurodeficiencies. We need to engage one another because all of our weaknesses and deficiencies are different from those of other people. God made every human being distinct. So the weaknesses I have are not identical to the weaknesses you have. But how we can help one another is, hey, I can work with you. I'll give you a little testimony. You know, being on the autistic spectrum, I wasn't really doing too well at engaging people as long as I was spending all my time in the Caltech astrophysics department. Why? Because that department was filled with people like me. And so we weren't really helping one another engage with normal people. It took spending concerted, focused time with people who were not like me and inviting them to help me overcome my deficiencies. So for example, I've been giving public lectures since I was 16, but when I was 16, when I would sit in front of an audience of a couple hundred people, I would just stare at the floor the whole time. And I was actually engaging people that were, neurotypical. They said, you'll probably do better with an audience if you actually look at people. And so over decades, I was able to actually say, okay, I can actually try to engage people by looking at them. In fact, one funny story was, my future wife basically said, you know, stop staring at the floor. You need to look at the audience when you speak. And so I gave this two-hour talk that included the Q&A, and she said afterwards, were you aware you just looked at one guy for the entire 2 hours? Are you aware of how uncomfortable you made that person feel? You need to actually focus your gaze on people throughout the audience. And so the next time she said, are you aware that you were just darting your eyes all over the audience? It's like every second you were moving your eyes. So it literally took me decades to figure out how to engage an audience like someone who's neurotypical. And if you're wondering why I'm so focused on these visuals on my computer, it's basically designed to help me overcome my handicap. Because if I try to focus on people in the audience, I totally lose track of where I am on my talk. But what works is, you notice this too, I try to set up my computer so I can look at what's on my computer, see the clock, and see you as well. So that if I had the computer down here, I'd be in trouble. If I had it too high, I'd be in trouble. I try to put it at just the right length. And people wonder why I don't like PowerPoint. I use Keynote because I can put a gigantic clock on it that tells me where I am in my talk. I had to use PowerPoint when I was speaking at the American Scientific Affiliation. They said, why did you end 5 minutes early in your sermon? It's like, well, I couldn't tell where I was. And they said, well, you could always look. But if I look, then I lose track with the audience. I lose track with my talk. So we adapt. All of us need to adapt, but we adapt by spending time with people with different strengths and different weaknesses. And by the way, what I find interesting about the human population, the percentage of people we have in the autistic spectrum is optimal for human civility and human civilization. The optimal number is about 1 out of 150. Also, we're at the optimal number for the number of people who have ADHD. I mean, the wonderful thing about people with ADHD, they're very good at changing the topic every 2 minutes. And for that reason, they make really good talk show hosts because they can keep things interesting and diverse for people who are amazingly listening or watching. And I've been on a lot of podcasts. The best hosts are ones that have ADHD. So we may think these are weaknesses. They're actually strengths in their particular arena.
Thank you, Hugh. Mr. C. DePew asks, he says, Hugh, I don't see any reason to interpret Melchizedek as figurative in Hebrews 7, like many say. Can you elaborate on if Melchizedek is just figurative or a real person?
Yeah, good question. That's in the book of Hebrews. And, you know, Melchizedek is also mentioned in the Old Testament, and there's been a debate among theologians. Is Melchizedek a figure of Jesus Christ, or is it actually Jesus Christ coming in physical form in the Old Testament? And I'm of the opinion it doesn't have to be either or. I think it can be both and. So as I look at what I see in the book of Hebrews and the Old Testament, I think some of what's being stated there is figurative, pointing to what's going to happen when Jesus Christ comes. But it also says that, you know, we have Abraham actually giving a sacrifice to this Melchizedek. And it seems like the way it's written, it's not just figurative. He really did do that. And you also got Hebrews saying of Melchizedek that he was a priest. And so you got this Melchizedek form coming as a priest before the Aaronic priesthood even existed. It's the first time you see any mention of a priest. So it's basically saying there's something different, distinct about this Melchizedek. Because in the days before Moses, the sacrifices were being done by the patriarchs, the main male figure within the family. But Melchizedek is referred to as a priest who is receiving a sacrifice from Abraham himself. And also refers to Melchizedek as having a permanent priesthood. And notice the priests of Aaron were not permanent. They were a temporary one. So again, it's figurative of the one who would actually be able to do the sacrifice that would save everyone. So personally, I think you can have it both ways.
Going back to the neurodivergent thing, I'd love to buy audiobooks from you at RTB, but I can't find any place to actually do that. I listened to your last book, Rescuing Inerrancy, on Spotify Premium, and I wanted to go buy audiobooks from you, and I just couldn't find it. Is there a place that I can do that, or is it not available?
Yeah, good question. Several of the books at Reasons to Believe already exist in audio form. We're in the process of making all of our books available as audio books. We're also in the process of making all of our books available as ebooks in at least four different formats. So normally we had Kindle with Amazon. We're basically saying, hey, we want people not to be, they have multiple ways of getting our ebooks. And so I think right now we've got six of our books that are available as audiobooks. This book we got coming out in the flood, our goal is to simultaneously release the print book, the ebook, and the audiobook. Now, I've been told by our team there may be a difference of a week or two between those releases, but that's our goal, is to have them nearly simultaneous in a release. And that's our goal for all future books. We're also going back and trying to bring some of our older books that are not available as audiobooks and making them audio. They do tell me that my books are a challenge because my books are filled with tables and figures, and they don't like all the end notes. So some of my books, it's 25% end notes, and trying to read those end notes in audio format can be a challenge. Although I've been telling our team, well, what if we put the end notes as an e-file and then just have the person read the rest of the text? But no, they want the whole thing available. And I kind of have a pity for people trying to do, because trying to accurately say everything that's in an end note, especially with all those DOI numbers, that's got to be a challenge. I'm glad I'm not the one doing it.
Hugh, this is our last question. True in Canada asks, Dr. Ross, what is the source for the Hebrew language number meaning associated with that particular number? For example, in Hebrew taxonomy, the number 31 equates to deity. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation about the numbers in biblical Hebrew and whether they have any significance. It's similar to what you've probably heard of as Bible codes, where people will look at the letters in the Hebrew language and try to assign meaning to each letter, distinct from just how they come out in words. Then there's also people who will put together all the Hebrew letters and basically say, let's count every 19th letter or every 11th number or every 15th one and see if we can come up with some hidden message in the text. There are a number of these scientists at Reasons to Believe have looked at these methods, these number methods and letter methods, and basically they've been able to demonstrate that there's no statistical significance to trying to pull a message out of the letters or the numbers that you see. and how they demonstrate. I think the one that was most spectacularly demonstrated, somebody said, well, here's, I won't name the Christian preacher who did this, who went through Genesis and tried to come up with all of these prophetic pronouncements that you can get from letter and number sequences in Genesis. He says, hey, you got 50 chapters in Genesis. That's a lot of data, and you can statistically manipulate it in thousands of different ways. Let me just show you how this works. He took the Gettysburg Address, which was much briefer, of course, and he used the same techniques on the Gettysburg Address and got all of these spectacular messages coming out of the Gettysburg Address. And so the point of the physicists who did this is that there's no mathematical significance to these messages you pull out of there. Just read what it says there like you'd read a newspaper or a book. Now, this is not unique to Christianity. Probably the most famous example outside of Christianity is Islam, where they basically take the Quran and they basically do a number step sequence. That's the one where they look at every 19th letter and come up with all of these hidden spiritual messages as a result. And basically it says that the Quran is a big enough book that you're bound to get some kind of message out of it. Because after all, who says it's got to be every 19th? Maybe it's every 20th. Maybe it's every 11th. If you go from 1 to 40, you're bound to come up with something.
Hugh, thank you very much. Would you please close us with a prayer?
I'd be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. We thank you for every day you allow us to live here on this amazing planet. Thank you that we're here to serve you and to serve other people. I pray, Father, that you grant each of us the wisdom to discern the specific purposes for why you've created us and what our mission is at this time and place in the course of our lives. And Father, we thank you too that when we follow through on that, you fill us with this overflowing love and joy. So Father, help us to gain more of that love and joy in Christ. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.